It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Today, doing the math. Another national report card is in, and it appears Americans are still not very good at math. A whopping three-quarters of high school seniors scored below their grade level. And adult Americans aren't much better. One survey found nearly a third of us would rather clean the bathroom than solve an equation. Why do so many people hate math?
What can math do for me? I was certainly that obnoxious teenager in high school geometry class that said, are we ever going to really use this in real life? Why do I need to know this? Because it just seems so irrelevant.
Math? How am I supposed to know that? I'm a beautiful, popular, rich kid with a promising future in a lightweight sorority at a state college. I don't need to know that stuff.
You're taking 12th grade calculus?
Yeah, I like math.
Ew, why?
Because it's the same in every country.
It's beautiful. This girl is deep.
People don't like to be wrong. For many people whose exposure to math entirely consists of going to school, that's their total experience with math, so who would like that?
At my old school, if you got a high score in math, all you got was this.
Hey, math. I bet that A won't keep me from kicking your ass.
Maybe it's just Hollywood that hates math. On the other hand, you have to wonder, if Americans didn't have such a bad attitude about math, maybe we'd be better at it. Mathematician Jordan Ellenberg would like to do something about that. He's a number theorist, author of the book How Not to Be Wrong, and he believes math is for everyone.
But math is not a foreign language. It's our language. It's the language our minds naturally speak. Every piece of math, whether it's basic arithmetic or algebra or probability or calculus, it is built on the natural way that we think about things. I mean, made more formal, made more powerful, made more generalizable. But it's not something that, like, comes from space and we have to be trained to do instead of thinking. It's a way to improve our thinking, and it's part of our thinking.
And yet, people often seem not just to say, oh, I'm not good at math. They say, I hate math.
You know, I think that another way that math is taught differently is it's presented as something with really high stakes, like you're right or you're wrong. And to some extent, that is part of the nature of the subject. There are right answers and wrong answers. But people don't like to be wrong. And for many people whose exposure to math entirely consists of going to school, that's their total experience with math. So who would like that? I would like to see a situation where being wrong is somehow not so bad, where it's understood that in math, like anything else that's worth doing, making mistakes is part of the process.
Well, and there's something you do with your students, I think, with your calculus students, and you tend not to just say you're right or you're wrong. You grade partly on are they actually thinking about what they're doing or not.
Right, exactly. I mean, the example I use in the book is, you know, there's wrong and there's wrong. There's different ways to get a wrong answer. So if somebody is doing a calculus problem where the answer is supposed to be the amount of water left in a bucket at the end of a certain amount of time, you know, one of these kind of slightly artificial problems that we often ask our students to undertake as part of a calculus test. If they say at the end of the appointed time, there's -4 grams of water left in the bucket, that's an answer so wrong as to be in a certain sense offensive. Right? Because of course there's not -4 grams of water left in the bucket. And if you write that, it's almost like you're saying, I'm rejecting the very idea that math has anything to do with the real world or that the things that you're asking me has any meaning besides these chicken scratches I've put on the page. No, math has meaning. Math is about things. And so I will give a student more credit, even if they've messed up the arithmetic somewhere. Okay, that could happen to anyone. But if they say, okay, I got -4, but I know that can't be right. That makes no sense. I know that. I don't know what the answer is, but I know it's not that. That means the person is actually thinking. They're using the mathematics and their minds together as they should, and that's worth more than zero.
Can you give us an example of how math can help us understand daily life?
Daily life. Well, daily life is very different for different people, right? So one example I like is about thinking about politics and thinking about what we mean when we talk about public opinion. Often this can seem rather contradictory and weird. So a classical example is if you ask Americans, should the government be bigger or smaller? They will say smaller. Doesn't matter who you ask, doesn't matter, old, young, liberal town like Madison, conservative town like Waukesha, doesn't matter. People will say the government should be smaller and it should spend less. Overall, it's like 70% say that, a huge majority. But if you dig down into that and you start to ask, okay, well, let's look at the different programs that the government funds. What about Medicare? Should we spend more or less on that? People say, well, that's good. People need health care. Okay, more on that. What about defense? Well, we have to stay safe. Like, we shouldn't spend less. We shouldn't cut there. What about the roads? Oh, I drive on the roads. That's important. That should be preserved too. And you go down the list of every major federal program, and every single one, the majority of people will say, well, don't cut that. That's
so they
important.
Want it smaller, but there's nothing they're willing to cut.
That's right. And it sounds like a paradox, right? And it sounds like the way that this is often written about is like, God, people are so stupid. Like, they don't grasp that if you want to cut spending, you have to cut spending on something. But when you think about this from a mathematical point of view, you arrive at a much more forgiving portrait of the American people. Seems like a contradiction is not a contradiction at all. Let's say everyone truly believes that spending should be cut. And let's say there's 10 programs we talk about. But let's say there's no consensus about which program should be cut. A tenth of people think it's Medicare. A tenth of people think it's the highways. A tenth of people think it's defense. Well, then for each program, 90% of people are going to say that's the one that shouldn't be cut. So it seems like evidence that the American people are somehow screwy or haven't thought through the consequences of their policy preferences. It really tells you that this notion of what is the popular will, like what does it mean for to have democracy? What does it mean for the government to obey what the people want is actually mathematically rather complicated. It's not as simple as you might at first think.
So how are we supposed to navigate in a world where statistics are being thrown at us right, left, and center constantly, and most of us don't know what to do with them?
Well, exactly, and it's a huge challenge. And I think one thing I want to push back on is I think that one way to deal with that is just to throw up your hands and say, oh, you can make statistics prove anything you want, so I'm just going to ignore statistics, and I'm going to ignore numbers, and I'm going to ignore quantities. What's the point of even living if that's your attitude? I mean, that's terrible. I think I don't think it's true that statistics can prove anything you want. But what I think is true is that we accord to numbers and quantities such an immense amount of prestige that in a sense, you know, somebody says a number and everybody else shuts up, right? Mm-hmm. That's the end of the story. Like, well, there's the number. There's the answer. And it comes back to this thing that we teach mathematics as a subject which is about getting the answer to a question when we should be teaching it. I mean, that's part of it, but we should also be teaching it as asking the right questions, figuring out what the questions are and how to analyze things.
So what do you mean by that? I wanted to ask for a few examples. One that you give that's a wonderful story goes back to World War II and this guy named Abraham Wald.
Right. So this is the story, and this is the story that leads off the book. It takes place, as you said, during World War II. Abraham Wald is part of this top secret institute, which is in New York, where some of the best mathematicians and statisticians are working on secret work related to the war. It's called the Statistical Research Group. So this place is kind of like the Manhattan Project, except it's actually in Manhattan. And at one point, the generals come to the SRG, and here's the problem they ask. They say, we're noticing that the planes that are coming back from Germany, the bullet holes are not distributed equally across the whole plane. There's more bullet holes on the fuselage. There's less bullet holes on the engine. We can see that they're going to hit more on the fuselage. So we want to know, is there like a formula or something? How much more armor should we be putting where all the bullet holes are so we know how to make the planes as safe as possible? And what Wald told them is that they had it exactly wrong, that they needed to put more armor where the bullet holes were not, where the planes were getting hit less.
Why?
Why? Because it wasn't that the Germans were incapable of hitting the planes on the engine. It was that the planes that were getting hit on the engine were the ones that were not coming back from Germany.
But that's so brilliant.
It's mathematics, and it's not mathematics in the sense of a formula or a computation or algebra. Although I will say that, I mean, I've read Wald's actual paper on this, and in the actual paper, there is lots of algebra and computation and probability. But the fundamental idea doesn't have any of that, but nonetheless, it's extremely mathematical in that it says, okay, here's the question that you asked, which parts of the plane have more bullet holes on them? And they had the correct answer to that question. It's just a matter of counting. But was that the question you should have asked? And it was not. And that's where the mathematics really comes in.
Mm-hmm. That shape of thought that you just described, stepping back from the question to say, well, is that really the right question? And is there a different question or should it be framed differently? Do you feel like you do that all day long yourself?
Well, one thing, something that we do in mathematics a lot in our practice of pure mathematics when we're trying to prove a theorem is, you know, they say you should try to prove your theorem in the day and try to disprove it by night.
Hmm.
Sort of an old mathematical saying. It seems like a strange thing to do, to work at cross purposes to yourself. But the point is that, you know, you're working on something, trying to prove something. But one thing, until you've proved it, maybe that thing is not true. So you owe it to yourself to spend a little bit of time trying to prove the opposite. And I think that habit of mind is extremely healthy. You know, F. Scott Fitzgerald famously said that the test of a great mind is whether you can hold two opposed ideas in your mind at once. And mathematicians always have to do that. And I think that's, in general, it's a very mathematical skill, but it's one that applies more generally. The things that you believe, the things that make sense to you, the things that feel right to you, you should spend a certain portion of each day or a certain portion of each month or a certain portion of each year trying to put yourself in the frame of mind of believing the opposite of those things, to put pressure on your beliefs. That's, I think, how you get in the space of stepping back from something someone's telling you and saying, "Is maybe that's the right answer to the question they asked, but is it the right question?"
Jordan Ellenberg is a mathematician at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's a number theorist, a columnist for Slate, and author of the new book, How Not to Be Wrong. When I was in high school, back in the dark ages, there was math and then there was calculus, the really scary stuff. Well, maybe it still scares some people, but not science writer Jennifer Ouellette. The title of her book says it all, The Calculus Diaries: How Math Can Help You Lose Weight, Win in Vegas, and Survive a Zombie Apocalypse. Steve Paulson was just a tiny bit skeptical.
Before you wrote this book, were you afraid of math?
Oh, yes. A lot of math anxiety. I was a former English major who, just through a weird twist of fate, ended up becoming a science writer specializing in writing about applied physics. But I managed to avoid math. I had a lot of anxiety around it. I'm definitely that person that sees an equation and just goes, "Ugh, I don't want to deal with that."
So what did it take for you to get through your math phobia?
I think the big thing was taking the math out of a classroom. I think that what you learn in the classroom is more rote mechanics, and that's very important. But it's like practicing your scales if you're learning to play the piano. You certainly need that technical proficiency. You can't be a good pianist without it. But if that's all you ever do, you will never go on to compose your own symphony. The way that scientists, for instance, use mathematics is as a modeling device. They look at the world around them, and they find interesting questions to ask, and then they say, "How can math help me answer this question?" That process is what I ended up doing without realizing I was doing it. I looked for math in my everyday experiences and said, "Where is the calculus? What are some questions I can ask in this situation that calculus can help me answer?"
So in your daily life, where does math fit into things?
You know, it's interesting. Everybody says, "Well, you know, what can math do for me?" I was certainly that obnoxious teenager in high school geometry class that said, "Are we ever going to really use this in real life? Why do I need to know this? Because it just seems so irrelevant." I wish what someone had told me was that what math teaches you is how to ask interesting questions and model the world around you. It's a lesson in critical thinking. And I think it does have practical purposes. I mean, certainly you have to understand basic concepts in mathematics that do deal with calculus, things like compound interest and supply and demand and things like that. If you're just even running, if you're a single parent and you're running a household, it is really helpful to understand those things in order to manage your finances.
Okay, I'm going to ask you to back up for a moment because I also was an English major, and yeah, it has been a long time since I ever took a math class. And I will say that, you know, when I'm trying to help my kids do their math homework, boy, it is sometimes a stretch. What is calculus?
Calculus is simply a very basic tool to study changing quantities as they relate to each other. So if you think about it, it has two ideas, the derivative and the integral, and the derivative measures a rate of change. For instance, how fast your speed might be changing over time. What the integral does is it looks at that rate of change and it says, okay, if I add up every little piece of that over time, I will get, say, a final position. What it is a tool to transform one question into another question. It's a translation tool. If you think about if you're on a roller coaster, I think the example I used was Space Mountain. You can't see where you're going, but you can feel it from the effects of your acceleration. So you know your acceleration. You can actually, there's an iPhone app that will tell you what that is. You can take essentially two separate integrals in order to get to transform it into a mathematical function that will tell you your position at every point. You can retrace your path.
Now, you mentioned trying to figure out compound interest, for instance. Tell me how this might work.
Well, you have to think about what you're adding. I mean, I think most of us understand the basic idea of interest. We don't understand how a simple 1% change either way, for instance, on a mortgage, can end up costing you a lot of money. And it's how this interest is calculated. It's actually important whether it's calculated by day or by year, because what you're doing is you're adding up little bits over time. And as you add interest, your total amount changes. It accumulates. So you end up earning more interest as that base salary grows. And it's also
So if I'm thinking about refinancing my home mortgage, for instance, what should I know based on the principles of calculus?
You need to look at how your interest is computed. You need to ask yourself, first of all, what's the percentage rate? Is it worth doing? If the percentage rate is even 0.5% lower or a full percent lower, it might be worth doing, because you could end up over, you know, a 15, 30-year mortgage, you know, saving like $10,000. Is that worth it to you? And you need to measure that against what it's going to cost you to actually do the refinancing. You also need to look at how it's computed, how the interest rate is computed. Is it computed by day? Is it computed by year? And kind of see what difference that makes. It teaches you to ask the right questions and be a little smarter about what you sign. And actually, gambling in Vegas is the same way. I mean, I think a lot of people don't understand how the casinos make so much money, which, you know, I think in craps is a 1.42% edge. That's the house edge. That's all it is. It's enough to build an entire city out there in the middle of the desert.
Tell me about that. So if I go to Vegas, want to play craps or something yeah. else? I mean, what should I do or not do to be smart about this?
There's certain bets that you can make and certain strategies that you can employ to ensure that you lose money as slowly as possible. And sometimes if you hit a probabilistic sweet spot, you can actually win money. We played craps for about an hour. We took an introductory class and they opened up a low stakes table. We ended up walking away with about $150.
Hmm. So you played for an hour.
But we only played for an hour. Uh-huh. Had we kept playing, and trust me, it was already starting, which is why we left, we were starting to lose. If you play long enough over time, you will lose everything. So you want to bet smart. You want to figure, I've got a fixed amount that I'm willing to spend. It's the equivalent, say, of two people, dinner and a movie, and this is what I'm willing to lose. And you bet smart, and you might make a little, you'll lose more. It's kind of a slow bleed. But over time, you can have a lot of fun. It's a fun game.
So you're saying that a basic knowledge of mathematics, maybe calculus in particular, will help us in some I mean, mm-hmm. whether it's playing craps in Vegas or figuring out our home refinancing. Is that pretty much it? Or are you talking about something more? Are you talking about kind of being competent mathematically as a citizen in this country?
I don't think that I expect all of us, I certainly don't expect me, to be math whizzes, but I think we do need a basic competence. I think that there are certain numerical concepts that we let ourselves be lazy about. Statistics, probability, compound interest are the ones that I think impact us most in our daily lives.
Well, we always read stories in the newspaper about statistics.
Exactly.
You know, some new health study saying, you know, such and such is either good for you or bad for you. And then
we think they contradict each other because we're not looking at what's actually being measured. We're not really mm-hmm. thinking. We're not really looking deeply. And we don't understand the difference in, you know, how you can measure something one way and measure it a slightly different way and get a completely different answer. How you mix your data is the first question a statistics person asks. And that just seems inherently dishonest, you know, to someone who doesn't know anything about math. But of course, you have to make certain assumptions. You have to shape that raw data in some way. And understanding that process is, it's very easy to introduce bias. It's very easy to skew the data. You can very easily lie with numbers and make it seem very significant mathematically. We need to be smarter and ask questions and a little more skeptical about the numbers.
Now, the common wisdom is that girls are not as good as boys at math,
yeah.
Whereas girls might be better at dealing with language, for instance. Do you buy that?
I actually don't. And it's interesting because I was told that all my life, or I absorbed that message. And I certainly thought, well, you know, regardless of whether I'm a girl, I know I'm not as good at math. I've really begun to question my notions that I had about innate ability, because I think back to where I became good with words and language. I learned to read at an early age, and I encountered words much, much sooner than I encountered numbers, and I started playing around with them and inventing my own little things and kind of exploring the world of words in a way that I never did with numbers. Of course I ended up being better at verbal skills. I was doing it more. mm-hmm. what I found is, you know, I'm actually quite good. Well, you know, the more you do the math, the more you work through these sorts of things, you start finding shortcuts. You actually start, you know, it starts to make sense, and you start to play around with the numbers a bit more, and you get insights. And that's really all it is practice.
So why is it that girls have been targeted this way? I mean, sort of, where does this come from?
I don't think anyone does it deliberately. I just think it's left over from centuries of just women not, you know, for a long time, they weren't even considered to be as intelligent as men. We've come a very, very long way. And many of the new gender studies have shown that, in fact, cultural differences, if you take away the cultural influence, you do not get the gender gap in math that you see elsewhere. But certainly, it's pervasive.
Science writer Jennifer Willett talking with Steve Paulson. She's the author of The Calculus Diaries, How Math Can Help You Lose Weight, Win in Vegas, and Survive a Zombie Apocalypse. Now, who says girls can't do math? When Sarah Flannery was just 16 years old, she won the EU Young Scientist of the Year Award for her work making and breaking a new algorithm. Today, she's the chief scientist at a software company she helped found, so we asked her for a math problem we could do on the radio. She gave us one of her favorites, the Russian postal system puzzle.
I heard it at the end of a lecture on cryptography, and it was given to us by this Russian mathematician who stood up at the end of this lecture and just really wanted to give us this puzzle. The story goes that at one time the Russian postal system was notoriously corrupt. And what I mean by that is that any letter, package or box that was sent through the postal system, which was open or could easily be opened, would be. And the post office clerks would just go through the package or box or whatever and take out anything, whether or not it had any value. And obviously anything which did have value, they'd just pocket, and anything else they'd just throw away. But then, of course, the other end of that is that any letter or box or anything that went through the postal system locked, they wouldn't bother themselves opening it because their pickings were so rich and they'd just let it go through. And so then the story goes that there's this man, Boris, in Moscow, say, and his girlfriend, Natasha, lives all the way across the country in St. Petersburg. And Boris wants to get a jewel, a present that he's bought for Natasha, to her. And the problem is, how do they get it to each other despite the corrupt postal system? Like I said, if you do have a box and you can buy a padlock and lock it up and send it through the post, knowing that it will get, for example, to Natasha in St. Petersburg safely, but remember that Boris then can't, by letter, send the key because the postal clerks, they'll get this letter with a key in it, open it up, the key will have no value to them, but they'll just throw it away. I hope I've given everyone all the information. It's a long puzzle to set up. But yeah, that's it.
So let's see how you do. The trick is, how does Boris get his present to Natasha in such a way that she can open it? We're going to take a quick break, and we'll hear the answer when we come back. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. We left you mulling over that Russian postal system puzzle, and here's Sarah Flannery with the answer.
This is really one of those puzzles where I absolutely hate giving the answer to it, because it's one where you have to have a flash of inspiration, if you like. You either see it or you don't in order to get the answer. What Boris does is he takes this box, a box he has, and he attaches a padlock to it. He puts the gem in first, of course, and unlocks up the box with this padlock and sends it off to Natasha in St. Petersburg. And now, because it's locked, of course, it will arrive there. And when it does arrive there, and this is the solution to the puzzle really, what Natasha then does is she locks her own lock, to which she has the key, onto the box. And so now sends it back through the postal system again, with both her lock and Boris's lock on it. And so again, it'll arrive safely in Moscow. And when it does so, Boris, because he has the key to his padlock, can then take his padlock off and then send it back to St. Petersburg to Natasha. And when it arrives this time, all it will have is Natasha's lock on it, to which she has the key again, and so she can open it and get her gem. Yeah, so that's what that really is. It's a cute little puzzle. Again, this is an example of something where you're doing a puzzle and the answer is so simple, but it may never have got, you know, it may never have struck you really. But also what you're doing at the same time is demonstrating how you can achieve secure communication over an insecure channel, which is something that, you know, a little child could do if the answer came to them.
Sarah Flannery wrote about her own math education in a memoir she wrote with her father called In Code, A Mathematical Journey. There's math behind so many things we do, like shuffling cards. Where they fall seems random, but there are laws of probability, even mathematical formulas behind their behavior. We learned this from one of the world's leading mathematicians, Percy Diaconis. He holds a chair in statistics and mathematics at Stanford, and he's also a former stage magician. In his world, what looks like magic often turns out to be math. A while back, Jim Fleming asked how he found his way to both.
When I was growing up as a kid in New York City, I wandered into a magic club and then wandered into a magic store, and magic was my hobby, and for Christmas I got little magic tricks, and I learned mathematics through magic tricks.
But by the time you were 14, I've read, you were off performing magic. You were developing a career as a magician.
I did have an amazing thing happen. In New York City, the magicians hang around the cafeteria after the magic stores close, and the greatest sleight of hand expert of the 20th century, a man named Dave Vernon, sort of picked me up and was nice to me and taught me tricks, and one day called and said, "I'm going to Delaware tomorrow. You want to go?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, meet me on the West Side Highway at 2 o'clock. And I did, and ran away from home at 14 and never went back.
And this is when you began to discover that there were people who were using sleight of hand and magic to cheat people.
That's right. With Vernon, we would travel around trying to pick up people who are skillful with cards. And for example, one of the things I learned is that there are gamblers who can take a deck of cards and shuffle it perfectly, cut it exactly in half and go 1-1-1-1-1, drop, 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 so that the cards alternate perfectly. Imagine that you could do that, and to see why a gambler might be interested in that, picture the four aces on top of the deck. If I shuffle them once perfectly, the aces are every second card. Yeah.
Yes.
If I shuffle them twice perfectly, the aces are every fourth card. And then if I deal four hands, I get the aces.
Oh, my word.
And because of that, gamblers think, what exactly can I and can I do with perfect shuffles? For example, is there a way of shuffling cards perfectly so that the aces come to the dealer if you deal five hands? That's a math problem. And it's not such an easy math problem.
Does it require setting up the deck first?
No. There are two ways of perfect shuffling. You can shuffle perfectly so that the original top card stays on top. That's called an out shuffle, like an outie belly button. And you can shuffle the cards perfectly so that the original top card goes second from the top. That's okay. Called an in shuffle. Ins and outs are two different kinds of perfect shuffles, and they give you a little freedom. Magicians discovered, and I learned when I was 13, that if you wanted to bring the top card to a given position, say, if I wanted to bring the top card to 6 or 22, I would express the position I want to bring the top card to in binary. And then binary is, of course, a string of ones and zeros. If I interpret 1 as an in shuffle and 0 as an out shuffle and do that sequence of shuffles, that works. The card comes to where I want.
So just simply and not sure. Accurately in this case, you would alternate the out shuffle and the in shuffle in a sequence that was predefined.
Right. So, for example,
to move one card to a particular place.
If I wanted to bring the top card to position six, you express one less than six, it turns out, which is five in binary. Five is 101. And I would have to do an in, an out, and an in. And then the top card will come to position five. Well, that's miraculous when you hear about it, but it's a wonderful way to learn about binary numbers.
Yeah.
And that's the way I learned about binary numbers.
Just out of curiosity, when you learn to shuffle this way, I suspect you can do this.
Guilty as charged, sir. One of the things I learned is that if you have a 52-card deck and if you shuffle it perfectly eight times, it comes back to where it started. Even though it looks as if the cards are, they are being shuffled, but because it's a repetitive, perfect process, the cards come back to where they started. I often do that in public talks. And there aren't so many people who can do that. Maybe 100 people in the world who can shuffle a deck of cards eight times perfectly in under a minute. Of course, you could do it slowly.
Was that the most difficult magic trick to learn?
Oh, it's hard to say. You know, I learned perfect shuffles from a great magician who was visiting the New York City magic scene when I was 13. When you're 13, who knows how many hours I spent shuffling cards? You know, kids will just practice and practice and try and practice. It wasn't hard for me.
One thing that's clear from talking to you is that the magic of magic has stayed with you. But at some point, you shifted your balance toward mathematics. And that can't have been easy for a kid who ran away from home and school at the age of 14.
No. I wanted to figure out about probability theory because the gamblers kept saying fascinating things about probability theory. The fact that if there are 23 people in a room, it's even odds that two of them have the same birthday. How do they know that? How do they figure that out? I asked a friend, what's the best book about probability? He told me, William Fellows, An Introduction to Probability and Its Applications. I bought one at 16, and I couldn't read it because I didn't know calculus. But I could turn the pages, and I could see it was just wonderful. There was this world of ideas and tools for understanding the world around us and figuring out how to tame randomness that I wanted to touch. And so I went back to school to learn to read Feller. And now I teach out of it.
Does learning the math behind magic tricks lead you in other directions? Are there applications you can see where it might be of use to be a magician mathematician?
Well, there are two answers to that. Certainly, for me, new mathematics has come out. I'm giving a talk about a card trick that I used in my nightclub days. And the mathematics behind the card trick has been used to read DNA strings. It's been used in the smart pens that people use. I don't know if you've seen those. There are these pens that you write and the pen records what you've written.
And then you can load it into the computer and it'll explain what you wrote.
And the way those pens work has mathematics behind it, and the mathematics is the same as the mathematics of our card trick.
What's the card trick?
The card trick is a deck of cards is tossed out into the audience, and the cards are cut, 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 and you say, would five people each take a card, and people take the cards off, and you say, this is going to sound funny, but would you each concentrate on your card and try to send me the signals? I see red better than black. Would everybody with a red card please stand up? Some of the people stand up. Say, you have the seven of diamonds. You, the other guy with the red card, that's the jack of hearts. The people with the black cards, that's harder for me, and I name the black cards. The way that trick works is when the people stand up, there's enough information in the pattern of their standing up to give me the names of the cards.
Because of where they are in the audience?
Because of where they are, because of the pattern of their standing up. That is, nobody could stand up, all five people could stand up. There's some subtleties there that I'm not at liberty to explain, but the fact is
that... But if you go study math, you can find out.
You can find out. But in the same way, when the pens work, the piece of paper underneath them has little dots and dashes, like Morse code, but it's a two-dimensional Morse code. They're called de Bruijn sequences. And the background material, which is quite hard to see with the naked eye, is how the pen knows where it is on the page. And it's the same math that lays out those de Bruijn sequences so that every page is different and every part of every page is different. And it's easy to know where you are, and it's easy for the pen to go back and say, oh, yeah, that pattern, that's on page 32 of book one. to do that efficiently all has math hidden in it, and that math was first done for the mathematics of a card trick.
Do you get the same kind of satisfaction from doing math that you got from doing magic?
It has a similar satisfaction in the sense that every once in a while you see, you have a problem, you keep turning it over, you keep turning it over, and then you go, oh. And for a minute, there's a really wonderful feeling of just how beautiful the world is. And then, after about that minute is over, you think, how could I have been so stupid and taken so long to have seen it?
Percy Diaconis is an expert on randomness. He holds a chair in statistics and mathematics at Stanford, and he's a former professional magician. As long as we're talking about magic and math, there's a famously magical number. So famous, there's even a day named after it. Here's Jordan Ellenberg again on the number called pi.
It's one of the most fundamental of all numbers. It pops up in all manner of unexpected places. For instance, if you take two random numbers and ask whether they have no common factor, I don't know if that's something you ever do in your daily life, but suppose that you did, you would find that the chance of that happening is 6 over pi squared. Very strange, right? It has nothing to do with circles, nothing to do with radii. But this number is somehow sort of a controlling constant that governs all kinds of mathematical objects that don't visibly have to do with geometry or anything like that. You know, it's what's called an irrational number. I mean, the very name kind of suggests mystery. Irrational things are those things outside the bounds of reason. I mean, I think the coincidence of those two terms, I think, goes all the way back to the Pythagoreans. They really thought of all numbers as fractions, as ratios of two whole number quantities. When they discovered that there were some numbers that couldn't be expressed this way, they were really upset. We take math pretty seriously now, but the story about the Pythagoreans is that the first guy to discover the existence of an irrational number was thrown into the sea and drowned. They were so angry that their whole system of thought was in danger. 3.14159265358979. There's no kind of mathematician, no kind of physicist, no kind of engineer who doesn't grapple with pi. Not because they're going to look for it, but because pi comes and finds them. Pi 3.14159265358979732384626432387950288419716939. In your ordinary everyday life, I think on some level, like whether you think of it or not, you understand the geometric principle underlying pi, that principle that the ratio between the different parts of a figure doesn't depend on what size the figure is. So when we say all circles are the same shape, really, without knowing it, we're asserting the existence of pi. It's also Einstein's birthday, March 14th. I'm not sure if he knew his birthday was pi day. That's an interesting question. You may think, okay, circles are interesting because in our world that we live in, you see circles a lot. It's the most fundamental curved object, right? But of course, Einstein's realization was that the space we live in is itself curved. I'm sure he wouldn't have put it this way himself, but he was certainly a figure in emphasizing that pi is not only a feature of things that look round to our eye, it's a feature of the fundamental curved nature of the space in which we live. 1415926595. If you really ask yourself, what is pi? Like, let's say you really wanted to get to know it. Like, what is it? No matter how many digits of it you write down, you're never going to really know what it is. So its digits are kind of a red herring. In some sense, the reason we don't know that much about the digits of pi is because, frankly, they're kind of meaningless. They go on forever. There's no end.
Mathematician Jordan Ellenberg. And that's it for our conversation about math. Coming up, August is Ghost Month in Taiwan, and it's the setting for a new murder mystery from Ed Lin. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now, bookmarks, writers on books they love.
I'm Brendan Kerner, the author of The Skies Belong to Us. And the book I'd love to recommend is Yukio Mishima's Confessions of a Mask. It's a classic of modern Japanese literature. And it's really not the kind of thing I typically read, to be honest with you. I usually am attracted to grand, meaty narratives that span continents or span vast amounts of time. And there's lots of action happening. And there's very little that happens. It's really just a coming-of-age novel about a Japanese boy during World War II. But it's a beautiful book. It's really so keenly observed, and it's really heartbreaking. It's really about alienation. The boy in this book realizes at a very young age that he's gay, and he's in a society where that's just something that's not talked about at all, and he really feels like he's the only boy in the world, and certainly in Japan, who feels this way. And it's a very formal, structured society and very militarized at this point. And he has to develop a way to operate in society, knowing these things are inside of him. And it's really a series of observations and moments that are written in this extremely well-observed, almost minimalist style, but so deeply felt. It really made an impact on me. And I really think of it in some ways as a companion piece to The Catcher in the Rye, another classic coming-of-age novel that made a huge impact on me as a teenager. But it's different in that, you know, Holden Caulfield railing against the phonies is a little different. It's a little more narcissistic. I think that in Confessions of a Mask, Mishima's main character is really talking less about himself and more about Japanese society, and specifically in this time and place where everything's falling apart, the old ways. The country's under siege from American bombers. There's a lot of scenes set talking about these bombing runs that are kind of tearing out the heart of the country. And I think that you've got this boy who's adrift because of his personal identity, and also adrift because he's seeing everything he's ever known. His whole country is falling apart, and he's trying desperately to fit in. So just a really tender snapshot of young alienation. And I always keep on going back to it when I really want to think about the interior lives of people I write about. I obviously write nonfiction, and so it's a different approach I have to take because I'm dealing with people that I talk to and know in a different way. But I think the way Mishima approaches inner conflict is just so perfect and on the nose and just really beautiful, even though at the same time it can be really gloomy and dispiriting. It's a book I know that I'll keep going back to and rereading for the rest of my life.
Brendan Kerner recommends Confessions of a Mask by Yukio Mishima. You can find more bookmarks plus an interview with Kerner on our website. That's ttbook.org. And now it's time for On Our Minds. This month, August, is Ghost Month in Taiwan. It's also both the title and the setting of a brand new mystery from Ed Lin. He's a journalist turned novelist, author of a series of mysteries set in New York's Chinatown. And this latest takes us across the ocean to Taipei's most famous night market and the skyscraper offices of young billionaire bankers. The book covers Taiwan's complicated political identity and relationship with mainland China, all during one of the most remarkable times of the year there, Ghost Month.
In Taiwan, there are strands of Taoist and Buddhist faiths that believe that the gates to the underworld are opened and spirits are free to roam about the island for the entire month. Several Taoist temples have a priest conduct an opening of, you know, some wooden gates to symbolize the spirits coming through. And the first day, so much money and incense, that is fake money, money that is only good in the underworld, is burned along with incense that it's known as National Pollution Day. So on the first day of Ghost Month, you'll see a lot of smoke. You'll see a lot of tables out in the street, lots of food being offered to quell the spirits.
Now, are these spirits all ancestors?
Oh, the city is teeming with ghosts, and you would naturally placate your ancestors. But the most dangerous ghosts are the ones that do not have any living descendants. And these spirits are looking to disrupt your life. There are a couple of different superstitions that you're supposed to hold to in Ghost Month in order to protect yourself from these
like
really
what?
Harmful ghosts. Like you're not supposed to whistle because that attracts the attentions of the ghosts. You're not supposed to leave your laundry drying outside because they will possess them. You're also not supposed to make big capital purchases like homes or cars because the ghosts will take possession of those as well. And home sales and car sales dip during Ghost Month.
And in the novel, you also write there's something about avoiding water. What's with avoiding water?
Well, there are spirits in the water, the spirits who drowned or were swept out to sea, during a tsunami. There are very disturbed spirits in the water waiting to pull you under.
There's a sense that the whole island is haunted. At least that's the sense I'm getting from listening to you.
Taiwan is a place that, even though it's known as Silicon Island because of its high-tech prowess, There's something very ancient to it as well, and the past and the present are just glued. They're Siamese twins. You can see it everywhere.
Well, we should talk about your novel. When it begins, your narrator, Jing Nan, he doesn't want anything to do with Ghost Month or any of the old superstitions. And yet in his own way, as the book progresses, it turns out that he's kind of a haunted character too. Can you tell us about him?
Well, for Jing Nan, he is also an orphan. His father passed away from cancer. His mother is killed on her way to the airport to pick him up. So I kind of wanted him to sort of symbolize Taiwan. There's this novel that was published in the 30s called Orphan of Asia. Hmm. And in a lot of ways, that's what Taiwan is and Jing Nan himself is. He's someone who wanted to leave Asia altogether and sort of be his own man in the U.S. But he discovers that even though he was in the mode of trying to be free, he was still trying to cling to something in the past, and that was preventing him from moving forward. And I sort of feel like that's the situation in Taiwan now, people clinging to the past, whether they hated the KMT or whether they love the KMT. It's sort of preventing the country from really being a real cohesive, gelled product.
Jing Nan, your character, at one point talks about having felt humiliated watching the Olympics in Beijing. What is Taiwan's current relationship with China like in a felt sense for people who are just walking around the street in Taiwan?
Well, as you know, when Taiwan competes in the Olympics and when they're represented in other international arenas, they're known as Chinese Taipei. Mm. And so Jing Nan, he feels like that is almost him. He's not able to be himself. He has to be this shadowy kind of guy on a shadowy island, eking out a shadowy existence.
You yourself grew up in this country. Yet clearly you know an enormous amount about Taiwan and what it feels like to be Taiwanese. Was this a big issue for you growing up?
Well, you know, personally, like a lot of Asian Americans, I grew up operating in two worlds, right? When you're in school, you're sort of you're clearly in America, but when you come home, you're almost in like Qing Dynasty China. And the Qing Dynasty was not too friendly to kids. You're definitely expected to excel. You have to get straight A's. You know, you
gotta
do this.
This is where we got the stereotype of the Asian tiger mom.
Oh, absolutely. Part of that Asian world was having relatives coming over to visit who, you know, would say, hey, you know, you someday you come to Taiwan with me. I get you married. Okay. And be like, okay.
So what kind of family stories did you grow up with? I mean, was there a family narrative or particular themes to the stories you grew up with?
No, the family narrative is extremely disjointed because it was a little dangerous because at the time, the Kuomintang had a lot of spies in the U.S. on college campuses and throughout the greater Chinese communities. And if you were speaking ill of the goal of reunifying with the mainland, there would be repercussions. Your family would be blacklisted in Taiwan. You wouldn't be allowed to travel back to the island. And this sort of period of political tension in the U.S. didn't really end until the late 80s. Martial law was lifted in 87. The first opposition party was formed actually a year before then.
So does that mean that growing up, were your parents really careful about what they said, and were you aware of that as a kid?
Well, you know, we did this thing that a lot of Chinese and Taiwanese American kids did, this awful thing called Chinese school. Every Saturday morning, we always missed the cartoons because we'd have to go to this thing. And in addition to learning Chinese, or rather not learning it in my case, there was also this sort of quiet indoctrination into how the communists were evil bandits who needed to be removed from China. That would always be sort of an underlying kind of thing.
So how does it play out in your family that you became a writer? Have you broken with expectations? Surely you were supposed to go into engineering or medicine or law?
I actually studied engineering. I have my undergraduate degree is in mining engineering. But, you know, I did this Asian American thing where I had two majors. You have one major for your parents and then you have one for yourself. I never finished the literature writing, but no, it was a definite break from what my parents wanted. I ended up going to graduate school for journalism, and my mother was telling me, you know, it's not too late for medical school for you. And I would say, well, it's not too late for medical school for you. She was an English major, so how could she tell me that I needed to go to medical school?
So as a writer, I'm curious about how all of this plays out for you. You're part of a second or maybe it's third generation of Asian American writers. What does that designation, Asian American writer, mean to you today? Is it an identity that you like or reject?
Oh, wow. Such a loaded question. I sort of feel like at times I can be an American writer, at other times an Asian American writer. I think I rarely hear myself described as a mystery writer.
And does that bother you?
I don't think it bothers me. You know, I have a 17-month-old kid.
Congratulations.
And, thank you. And, you know, in my 20s and maybe in my early 30s, you know, I was really struggling with this Asian American kind of identity. But, you know, I have a kid now and it's like I'm a father. That occupies most of my brain space now.
You've got some wonderful years ahead of you.
Oh, thank you.
Ed Lin is a 3-time winner of the Asian American Literary Award, and his new mystery is called Ghost Month. By the way, he's also an actor. He recently starred in a very funny short, it's like 8-minute long film, called The Potential Wives of Norman Mao. The link's on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find links to books and music from this hour. And speaking of music, much of what we played this hour were remixes based on compositions by Yannis Xenakis, who's a post-war avant-garde composer and one of the first to use mathematical models in music, applications of set theory, stochastic processes, and game theory. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. It's produced by Charles Monroe Kane, Doug Gordon, Sarah Nix, Raymond Tungekar, and Will Hinkes. This week's audio guru is Joe Hartke. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.